Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. For two decades, biologist Dr. Stan Booten has been studying the comings and goings of red squirrels in the Yukon, and his latest discovery about these little chatterboxes has to do with their personalities. And for what it's worth, Type A and Type B personalities are not confined to the corporate sandbox. And two young researchers working in the Mark Boyce Lab for Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Alberta have focused their attention on how to better manage wolves and ring-necked pheasants in southern Alberta. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The Kluane Red Squirrel Project is a collaborative effort between the Universities of Alberta, Michigan State, and McGill. The U of A's Dr. Stan Booten has spent the last 20 years observing generations of red squirrels that live in this part of the southern Yukon. Over time, Stan and his colleagues have learned a lot about these squirrels. They can outwit spruce trees, anticipating when there will be big cone crops and thereby adjusting the number of litters they have. They've also discovered these squirrels are exhibiting a genetic adaptation to climate change, and their latest work deals with personality. Yes, the mothers of these little chatterboxes can be classified as type A or type B personalities, and that can determine the success or failure of the family. The results of this research have been published recently in Ecology Letters and has captured the attention of media around the world.
While we've been following these animals, and the whole core of our work is to follow individuals from birth right through to when they die, and we keep detailed records on these individuals in terms of how they behave, where they store food, how much food they have, how many young they produce over their lifetime. And in the midst of doing that, we've always commented on, gee, some squirrels are very aggressive when you handle them, others are extremely docile, some are very easy to trap, others you have to work your butt off to try and in fact catch them. So in the back of our mind, we've always felt, well, there are these differences. We never called it personality before, although that was in the back of our mind. And with recent work and interest in the field of ecology coming from work in psychology, looking at personality, we started to put two and two together and began to measure this more carefully with the red squirrels. And sure as shooting, there are these individuals that consistently behave in one way versus another, just as you see in people where you have type A personalities that behave the same in many situations and much more docile types of individuals that seem to be consistent in the way they behave.
Well, how do you measure that?
Well, we have a number of kind of goofy experiments that we do, I guess. Is one is what we call an open field trial, and it's simply putting a squirrel in a small little box or maybe a meter by a meter that has places it can explore, and we record all of this by video and let the animal sit in this box for a while and look at whether it explores, whether it's very calm, whether it's frightened by what's going on. That's one way. And then another part of it is we lift one side of the box and expose a mirror to the squirrel. And poor little guy sees another squirrel close to him and reacts in very different ways, with the aggressive types actually going up to the mirror and attacking it, and the other guys turning their back and saying, I don't want to have any part of this other individual in the little box. And those are basic surrogates, if we will, or indicators of the personality. We also look at how the animal moves on its territory and across the study area, whether they range widely or whether they stay close to home. And all of these things correlate together. So if you're aggressive in the box, if you're aggressive to the mirror, you're also highly exploratory and tend to wiggle a lot more when you handle them, as opposed to a docile type, which is not very exploratory, tends to be very calm when you handle it, and doesn't attack the mirror.
Well, if you look at the differences between the two, are the ones that are docile, does that tend to run in the family, or are they individuals? And the same thing for the aggressive ones.
Yes, we don't know that yet, but that's what we're going to look at next. So we think it runs in the family. And so there's probably a very strong genetic component to it. But we have not been able to follow both mothers and offspring yet to see whether that's true. But we're getting the data over the next few years to be able to answer that to see if that's the case.
Is there any particular reason why they should have different personalities? Does it suit different reasons for adaptation?
Yeah, well, this is what we're interested in is why wouldn't all squirrels be very similar in terms of their behavior? And you'd expect that if natural selection would favor those individuals that have a certain personality that are best for doing the sort of life requirements of being a squirrel. But that's obviously not true. There's all this variation out there. And I told you the two ends of the continuum, but there's all kinds of types in between as well. So there is the variation, why? And we think the reason comes up is that if the world was always consistently the same, then it might be good to be always aggressive. But given that the world does vary a lot, and it certainly does for squirrels, their food supplies vary immensely from one year to the next, weather conditions, densities of squirrels vary. So it could be that under certain conditions, the aggressive types are favored. But then when the conditions change in the following year, maybe the docile types are favored under those new conditions. And so you get a balance taking place where it's not necessarily good to be one type in all situations, that different types are favored in different situations, then that would lead to maintaining the variation that you see out there.
How does this fit then with other things that you've observed over the years about squirrels and their ability to adapt?
Well, it fits into the fact that this personality does have an influence on how successful you are. So it's not inconsequential that you are aggressive or docile. We've been able to also measure whether certain individuals or types produce more babies that are successful in certain years versus others. And certainly that's the case, that some years the aggressive types have way more success in terms of their young surviving, and in other years the docile types do. So this is all relating back to us doing our basic studies of what characteristics lead to unsuccessful and successful squirrels over their lives. And our basic reason for much of this research is to actually look at evolution and adaptation to environmental conditions, and most importantly, at how animals change in response to how those environments change. We've done climate change work, for example, and looked at how squirrels change the time of their breeding. Well, we can also look at how maybe personalities in that might change with changing conditions as well.
How do squirrels compare to other animals in terms of personality? I'm just thinking about my cats and dogs that I have at home, or even my own kids. Every single one is different.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a consistent pattern that's shown up. So it's been well known in psychology circles for years and years that personality is a very easy thing to measure, and it's very consistent. It's only been the last 5 to 10 years, though, that ecologists have become excited about it and measured it in the field. But now there's probably dozens of examples where people have measured it. It's a consistent trait that can be, in fact, quantified and is a consistent in that individual over its life, it appears. So the true idea of personality is being maintained, and it's, you know, there's lots of examples coming up. Our study is kind of interesting, though, is because it's one of the first ones that actually looked at whether personality matters or not to the well-being of the squirrel, and it looks like it does.
Can you speculate about outcomes down the road with further research?
Well, we really want to look very carefully at how the personality of a squirrel is tied to some of its other characteristics, like when it breeds, how big its territory is, how fast its young grow, all of these other sort of characteristics we call life history characteristics, and see if there's packages of squirrels, packages of characteristics in a squirrel that tend to come together. And as a result, you can see these different types living in the system, or morphs we call them, that again we'll explore to see just how variable they are and whether that variation leads to greater or lesser success over time.
This research has certainly garnered a lot of attention around the world. Who has contacted you and written about this?
Well, one of my students was on Quirks and Quarks on CBC with the interest there, and there's been widespread interest across the U.S. and internationally to talk about this. And I guess, again, it's people like to get some idea that what they see in humans is not all that unique, and it's actually widespread in the animal world. And this is just another example that personality certainly isn't unique to humans, and that sort of consistent patterns are even found in crazy little things like squirrels even.
Thank you very much, Stan.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Stan Booten, a professor of biology at the University of Alberta and a collaborator in the Kluwani Red Squirrel Project. You can go to the Innovation Alberta website to hear more about Stan's work with red squirrels in relation to climate change and cone crops. The Alberta Conservation Association supports a research chair in fisheries and wildlife at the University of Alberta. Dr. Mark Boyce holds that chair, and graduate students in his lab are investigating a number of topics related to how we manage our activities on the landscape and how we can better protect our wildlife. One of those students is Tammy McClash. For her master's research, Tammy has looked at the ring-necked pheasant, a bird that's popular with hunters in southwestern Alberta.
Well, I was looking at the male pheasants, and the male pheasants are quite pretty birds. They're a large-sized bird with a long pointed tail, and the males have a green head with a bright red eye patch and a white collar around its neck. And so they're very distinct, and people love to have them around and watch them in their yards.
Why are we interested in pheasants?
People are really interested in pheasants because they were introduced in the late 1800s for hunting. People love to hunt them, and so that is why a lot of people are very interested in them.
Now, with your research, what exactly have you been looking at? What's the question or the problem that you're addressing?
Well, I've been looking at what landscape characteristics were influencing where pheasants were distributed and their abundance in the Eastern Irrigation District. And I was also looking at developing a habitat use model to identify within my study area where areas of prime pheasant habitat was located.
What habitat do they like?
They like areas that provide them cover, such as forage lands or the habitat that it often surrounds watercourses. It gives them that tall cover where they can escape from predators. As well, they like having a higher density of vegetation patches. So they love to have all the habitat that they need for their food, escape cover, and reproductive activities all in one close location because they prefer to walk around rather than fly.
What's the population like?
The population reached its peak across North America around the 1950s or 60s, and since the 1970s, their population has been declining. In recent years in my study area, the population has been remaining relatively constant, but the numbers are definitely down from what they were at the peak.
Well, aren't some of them released for hunting?
Yeah, every fall in my study area, pheasants are released. And the primary reason for that is that there is a wild population of pheasants within my study area, but the numbers just aren't enough to make up for the demand of the hunting. So pheasants are released every fall to supplement the wild population for hunting.
And where do they come from?
There is the Canadian Pheasant Company raises pheasants, and that's located in Brooks, Alberta. And so they raise them and they release them every fall.
So in your research, what have you found?
The most interesting thing that I've found is that there happen to be less pheasants closer to release sites, which is interesting. A lot of people think that there should be more pheasants closer to release sites, but that's just not what we found.
Well, what's happening? Are they running away as soon as they're released?
Two things that we think might be going on is that at the release sites, there's intense hunting pressure, and that hunting pressure is taking both the released birds and the wild populations, so that even when I come in springtime and do my spring counts, there still is a lower abundance of pheasants near release sites. The other possible thing is that the released birds are actually displacing the wild population, and it's known that released birds have a lower overwinter survival than wild birds, and so when I come in spring to do my counts, again, there's lower pheasant counts closer to release sites. It seems to be that releasing pheasants is making these release sites unfavorable for the wild populations.
Well, if pheasants are an introduced species, and then there has to be a certain number of pheasants released every year to satisfy the hunting sort of interest. Do the pheasants cause any problems for other birds or animals that are native to that area?
Well, pheasants have been known across their distribution in North America to be nest parasites. So they will go and drop eggs in like gray partridge nests, blue-winged teal nests, we don't have them, they're not here anymore, but the greater prairie chickens as well. So they do cause problems that way. They also have been found to be aggressive towards prairie chickens and to sharp-tailed grouse, and also disrupting other birds' mating displays as well.
With your research study, what conclusions have you come to?
I've come to conclude that pheasants are basically selecting areas that give them cover and that interspersion of habitat patches. So those are really important to figure out where they are. And then that we really need to rethink the issue of releasing pheasants, because it potentially may be causing harm to the wild population. So more research really needs to be done on to really tease out exactly what's going on there.
Is there a drive, though, to maintain a pheasant population there for the hunters?
Yes. People love to hunt pheasants, and so that's exactly why they release them, to supplement the wild population. So and I'm definitely not suggesting to stop hunting, because it is. That's why pheasants are here. And so I think it's just a matter of trying to figure out what is the best strategy, because we certainly don't want to be decreasing the wild populations, because they are the ones that survive better. So we need to really sit down and think about strategies to help everyone.
Any suggestion?
I think that we should maybe be focusing our efforts on enhancing habitat for them. Habitat will then enhance the wild populations. And I guess it just further research needs to be done on exactly what's going on with these releasing these pheasants, and once that's done, then we can develop more effective strategies for that.
Thank you very much, Tammy.
Thank you very much.
That was Tammy McClash, a graduate student of Dr. Mark Boyce in Biological Sciences at the University of Alberta. Her research was supported in part by the Alberta Conservation Association. About this time last year, I interviewed Cheryl Hadkevich about her PhD research on cougars and bears in southern Alberta. As a student of Dr. Mark Boyce, the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fisheries and Wildlife, Cheryl was looking at how these animals move around the landscape and whether we could model wildlife corridors to reduce conflict with human activities. Now another of Mark's students, Andrea Morehouse, is building on that research by looking at the movement of wolves.
Like you said, I'm going to be in southwestern Alberta. The area is a little bit north of Highway 3, south of the border, and they think that there's likely six packs in that area. Don't know too many of the details about the pack size and numbers that are there. Still sort of trying to figure that stuff out.
What do you like about wolves?
Because they're such a controversial critter, I think that they're really interesting. I think that from both a conservation standpoint, in that they are sort of this top carnivore in the ecosystem, but they also can really cause some problems from a rancher's perspective. And so I think sort of that interplay between management and conservation is an important and interesting issue.
Well, why should we keep wolves on the landscape?
Because of their role as sort of this top carnivore. They play a pretty important role in the food chain process and sort of in regulating prey densities, and just they fill that niche of being a carnivore in the ecosystem.
You're going to be covering a fairly large area. Do these wolves move around a lot?
Yeah, they can move around quite a bit. Pack territories for wolves are documented at about 250 up to 2,000 square kilometers for a pack. And there's records of a single male wolf dispersing, I think it was about 917 kilometers. So they can move quite a far distance, which also makes them sort of a focal species perhaps in some regions, because they can cover such large areas, in that the hope is sort of that if we can accommodate their needs, we might accommodate the needs of some smaller species as well.
The research that you're just getting started on, what's the question that you're addressing?
We are trying to look at what features influence the movement patterns of wolves. So how are wolves moving across the landscape? What landscape variables influence that movement? And what habitat features wolves are selecting for?
How are you going to do it?
We plan on collaring at least one wolf from each pack, from a little ways north of Highway 3, south of the border, and we plan on fitting them with GPS collars that will take locations every hour, so that we'll end up with this really detailed movement information for them, and then we can use that information to create a model that will illustrate what features influence their movement throughout the landscape.
Will you be involved in the actual collaring? How would you do it?
I hope to be. We've been talking to a bunch of different groups that are doing work in the area, and sort of the methods for capturing wolves are either aerially by helicopter darting or using live snares or leg hold traps. So it just sort of depends. If there's a wolf pack that already has a collar on it, it's a little bit easier to get them via the helicopter because you know where to look. But if it's a new pack that doesn't have a collar, your better bet is often to put some snares out so that you can try and at least get one individual collared so you know where the rest of the animals are. And we'll likely be working with SRD folks in the area to try and put those collars on. And hopefully I'll be involved in some of that process, but still learning about those things.
What are the different habitat concerns for these wolves? What pressures are they under now?
There's a lot of pressure from the sort of the ranching community, which is a big part of sort of the economics in that southwestern region of Alberta. It's a big ranching community. And so there's obviously a lot of pressure there from in terms of where wolves are, if they're on these ranches, and are they eating the cattle and that sort of thing. And so from a management perspective, if we can understand how they're moving through the landscape and how much time they're spending in each of these areas and what sort of influences those decisions, that could be quite helpful information for the ranchers as well as the managers in that area.
What about development from urban people or acreages? Is that happening in that area as well?
Yep. The Highway 3 is scheduled to sort of double. The twinning of Highway 3 is something that is coming up. And so that's another question sort of from the conservation standpoint, is how will wolves respond to that, and how do they respond to roads, and where would be the most appropriate place to designate a corridor for them in that region?
other people have looked at these sorts of things where you try and model how animals move, and it's not an easy task, is it? What has happened in the past, and how can you learn from that and apply it to the work that you're doing?
There's been a couple other students in the lab that have done similar work. Cheryl, in particular, has worked in the same sort of region with cougars and bears, and she's also been looking at how that relates to corridors, their movement, how that relates. And so I can sort of build upon some of the stuff that she's done and add wolves to that suite of sort of top carnivores in the region and see how they fit into that bigger picture as well.
Do you have any indication at this time as you're heading out what you might find?
I think there's a bunch of sort of different things playing into it, and I think that we'll find that there's certain times of the year that they are more likely to be in certain areas, especially because past research has sort of indicated that wolves are, in some respects, habitat generalists, and they're more limited by road density and prey density rather than specific types of habitat. So I would imagine that there's probably sort of this critical balance between those prey densities and the road densities that influences where they are in the landscape.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Andrea Moorhouse, a master's student in the lab of Dr. Mark Boyce, who holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Genome Alberta, the University of Lethbridge, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crocher.